You are listening to the Cycling Podcast.
Hello and joining you on January the 24th, 2024. That is the 40th anniversary of Apple's first incarnation of the Macintosh personal computer hitting stores. The Mac, which New York Times tech correspondent at the time, Eric Sandberg Dement, said would be destined for greater things had it been named the Granny Smith after the variety of apples first discovered by Maria Ann Smith, aka Granny Smith, in Australia in 1868. And so we get to our extremely tenuous link to today's episode. My name is Daniel Freiber. I'm the host of this episode of the Cycling Podcast, in which we will set out why it was a golden and delicious edition of the Tour Down Under. And we'll get to the core of some other big stories developing in the world of cycling this week. Joining me to do all of that is the mustachioed maestro. We'll be talking about moustaches. Mitch Docker, who has had a very busy week at the Tour Down Under. Mitch, how are you doing? You're looking quite bronzed, I must say.
Well, yeah, well, that's because I did ride across the TDU. That's become something for me the last couple of years. I head out from my hometown here in Lancefield, well, Melbourne anyway, not too far away, and ride across there. Last year, I did it over 5 days. This year, I did it over three. I thought it'd be a good idea just to challenge myself that bit more. Yet I'm further away from the pro peloton. I'm doing less Ks, yet I wanted to do it even harder. I'm sick, and like I literally probably 80K into the first day, I was like, this was such a stupid idea. And of course I made it, but it was good. Like I'm fit. That's what you got to do. I did all my fitness in 3 days, and I'm back where I used to be. Well, maybe not back to World Tour level, but I'm at a good level.
I was going to say, inching ever closer. Who knows, next year. do it in one day next year, and maybe that comeback will be on. Joining us also, not from Down Under, but Down Under as far as France is concerned. I think he's in Marseille. It's François Tourmazeau. François, how are you?
Not too bad, actually. Not too bad, yeah. In Down Under, Marseille.
François, are you celebrating? Because last time you were on the podcast, it was a speculation episode, and we talked about how you not doing the Tour de France might allow French riders to end their drought in the Tour de France. Well, I can tell you that this week you should be celebrating, because France won the World Boulangerie Championships for the first time in 16 years, ending a 16-year drought. Did you know that? Did you follow the World Boulangerie Championship?
No, I missed that, but I saw a couple of stories on TV about a few like cuisine, you know, world championships and prizes that France had not won for a while, and you know, getting, you know, coming home. So yeah, keep posted. I mean, we're back. So you know, I'm looking forward to the Tour de France, and I mean, if my prediction comes through, I think I really need to have a statue of me, you know, just in front of the headquarters of ASO or something, you know. As but we'll see.
I think the baguettes might be coming home rather earlier than the than the Tour de France title does.
Who won it then? Before France, the last 7 years.
I'm not sure, Mitch, but the favourites this year were Taiwan and South Korea. As you can tell, I've been doing a real deep dive into this. Yeah, this in spite of the fact there's one Boulangerie, François, per 2,000 inhabitants in France. Unfortunately, 1,985 of them are closed most of the time, in my experience. But yeah, they've been in the doldrums, François. Lots of talk among the French boulangers interviewed by, I think it was in Le Parisien, I read about this, talking about how inventive the Asian bakers are, and how they can't compete on that front with their humble baguettes.
It's like the same with wine, you know. If you look at South African wine, Australian wines, you know, American wines, even Italian wines, I found out by doing the tourist guide recently, they've all been actually invented and, how could I say, monitored by French guys. I mean, the biggest wines in Piedmont, for instance, they were planted in the mid-19th century, By Cavour with the help of a French guy. So I mean, we initiate things like the Tour de France, and then we don't win it. I mean, that's
And you
the thing.
become very bad at things. Chaps, we should talk about some cycling. As tradition dictates, we're going to start with a news roundup, trying to keep them slightly more concise this year. First, we're duty bound to journey to Benidorm on the Spanish Costa Blanca for some cyclocross. We had the latest rounds of the World Cup there at the weekend. And finally, we also had a bit of a surprise with Mathieu van der Poel not taking first place, mainly because of a crash. And a saddleless, I think multiple crashes actually, Van der Poel. And a saddleless Wout van Aert finally breaking the MVDP hex to triumph. There was a rather unsavoury postscript to that, which we may mention in a minute. First, we'll cover the women's race and tell you that was won by Femke van Empel ahead of Puk Pietersen. And we will also tell you that Selén del Carmen Alvarado's third place was enough to confirm her as the overall Women's World Cup winner with one round to spare. Chaps, I said an unsavoury postscript. Did you have the misfortune to see the E3 Saxa Bank Classic, I think it's called now, isn't it? You chaps will know that this race has become infamous for its tasteless adverts over the years. Beginning, I think, way back in sort of 2011, I think was the first one. There were a couple, 2015, 2016, which one of them in particular was sort of based on Peter Sagan's bum-pinching incident. Which race was that? Was that at Flanders? Or maybe the previous year, Gent-Wevelgem. And well, they sort of outdid themselves this week, E3, by putting a cartoon on X, formerly known as Twitter, showing Van Aert crossing the line saddleless, as I said, which was a representation of real events, and then some allusion to, well, the LGBTQ community enjoying this, because obviously his sort of saddle, his seat post was sticking up in the air, and Mathieu van der Poel fans supporting the sort of rainbow jersey, rainbow flag, thinking that this was great, him having a sort of seat post sticking towards his backside. You chaps, you laugh. Some people did find it funny. However, being serious for a moment, first of all, the race organisation E3 did apologise. I mean, men's cycling, there are no openly gay riders, and I think that is a justifiable sort of concern that it has been a hostile environment possibly for any gay bi riders. Women's scene is different, of course, but this, as I say, this is an organization with a pretty terrible record of misogyny. So, you know, I saw some replies to this, even people who said online that they were gay, they were bi, they found it funny. You might say, well, give them the benefit of the doubt. I would say that this organisation doesn't deserve the benefit of any doubt based on its past record. Any thought that they were laughing with the LGBTQ community and not at them is sort of removed, I would say, by their record on these things.
Well, it's obviously meant to be offensive, so it's not funny, you know? That's the thing.
Yes, exactly. And you know, one does wonder as well, they've done this so many times that, you know, they are obviously sort of self-proclaimed agents provocateurs, but you kind of wonder why they are doing it at this point, because obviously the organisation, this race has corporate sponsors, Saxo Bank in this case. I struggle to believe that any kind of corporate sponsor would be on board with this or okay with this.
No, can't be impressed at all. Yeah, it's a strange move, isn't it? You know, like, and they think, sometimes I feel someone just doesn't think and it goes out and they're like, oh, whoops. We didn't really think about that, did we?
And also, as far as the UCI is concerned, chaps, I mean, this is a World Tour race. You imagine, you know, a rider posting something like that? I mean, we've had incidents in the last couple of years of riders doing things in poor taste and being suspended by their teams or being fined, even being suspended by the UCI. So, again, pretty difficult to understand. We should move on, chaps. We'll go to the road first. The cyclocross season, of course, is winding down. The road racing season is cranking up. The season on the European mainland began this weekend in Spain. Some of the top women's teams have been in Mallorca for their version of the Challenge Mallorca. Three rounds of that were won by Naomi Rueg of EF Education Cannondale, Magdalene Valliere of EF Education Cannondale again, and Eleonora Gasparini of UAE Team ADQ. Just across the Med on the Spanish mainland, Dylan Groenewegen won the Classic at Comunidad Valenciana, and his JCO Lula teammate Michael Matthews won the Gran Premio Castellón. The men have also now moved to Mallorca, and the first round of their Challenge Mallorca will take place today, I believe. That's Wednesday. Big few days for Gran Tour wildcards. Total Energy and Uno X have got the nod for the Tour de France, while Team Polti Cometa, formerly Aolo, VF Group, Bardiani CSF, Faizané, and Tudor Pro Cycling have been invited to the Giro d'Italia. The Giro d'Italia, whose seventh stage, we should remind you, is the Tudor individual time trial from Foligno to Perugia. So a real shock that they got the wild card there. Also remember that Lotto Destiny and Israel Premier Tech go to the Tour de France by virtue of their ranking position, while Lotto have waived their right to race the Giro, and only Israel will go. Francois, these decisions, wild card announcements, they always used to be sort of shrouded in controversy. There always used to be uproar. There was for a period. There was always one party, one team that was very disappointed indeed. It doesn't seem to be the case these days. I would suggest that Total Energy and Uno X were shoo-ins, pretty much, weren't they?
There used to be more rooms available, like, you know, four teams could be in, you know, get wild cards in the old days. And it seems to be, you know, they're trimming down on the wild cards gradually. So, and I mean, Total Energy, I think since Bernardo launched the team in 2000, they've done all the Tour de France. I couldn't see, you know, whatever their results. I mean, they're part of, it's like Cofidis doing the Vuelta. I mean, you know, they're there was no way the Total Energy was not going to be at the Tour de France. And obviously, ASO, you know, apparently, you know, a good relationship with Uno X. I've always heard Christian Prudhomme speak, you know, kindly about them and the way they were. So there was not a surprise by any means. And these days, there used to be problems when you had French teams left out of the Tour de France, and so the French press would say, oh, we should have taken French teams like the Italians are doing on the Giro or the Spaniards on the... But these days, and most of the French teams are either on the World Tour or are Total Energy and you are sure to be doing it. So, I mean, the controversies used to crop up from a French team being left out of it, but it's not the case anymore. So I don't think that there were too many doubts about who would be picked for the Tour.
Your mate, Jean-René Bernardo, Francois, the boss of Total Energy, who I saw in an interview this week, suggested that ketones and some teams using ketones was the only reason that professional cycling wasn't the biggest sport in the world, because of the moral ambiguity that this created, which made me raised an eyebrow, raised a chuckle. Chaps, a footnote to the wildcard announcement. Uno X Mobility announced in the wake of their invitation that Tor Husovd would replace Jens Haugland as the general manager of the team. Haugland had previously held the role of general manager for both Uno X, the teams, because they have a women's team and a development team as well, and Uno X Norway, the company, car washes, petrol stations and so on. Jens, we've had him on the podcast, and he is a very colourful, larger-than-life character, and he's been a real breath of fresh air as general manager of that team. He is, we believe, staying with the company, but has been replaced by Tor Husov. Slightly disappointing news. I think Jens himself will be slightly disappointed with that news. We'll maybe speak to him in the next few weeks. Staying in Norway, we should inform listeners that the Edvald Boassenhagen Ultras, among our listeners, there are one or two of them, will be delighted that their idol will ride for Decathlon AG2R La Mondiale in 2024. Rumours had it that EBH was close to retiring. Not so. Meanwhile, sadly, it is the end of the road for our good friend, sometime guest, latterly Astana rider, Joe Dombrowski, who announced last night that he is going to end his pro career at age 32. Joe won Giro stage in 2021, tour of Utah stage and the GC in 2015, and a 2019 tour of Utah stage. Joe, as I said, announced his retirement just last night. And this morning, the morning after, he sent us this voice message.
Hi everyone, it's Joe Dombrowski. As you may have seen, I announced my retirement as a professional cyclist yesterday. It was something I thought a lot about before I said anything to the public. And actually, it was something that was not that easy to actually say, to be honest. I had a laugh last night. My wife and I were eating dinner in the kitchen and my doorbell rang, and packages don't normally come in the evening. And when we get a doorbell buzz at that time of day, usually it's for a doping control. And sure enough, it was for anti-doping. And it was just funny because we were all sitting there around the kitchen table because it took a while. The doping control officer noticed that my phone was really buzzing all the time. And I said, yeah, I mean, I announced that I was going to retire as a cyclist an hour ago. The whole thing was just a bit ironic, really, because it was a nice surprise and a nice feeling that I received so many messages from so many different people who have been a part of the journey. I'm sort of just getting to all that now and just want to say thank you to everyone who, you know, has reached out, and thanks for following along during my career. Yeah, I'm looking forward to whatever comes next. I don't know exactly what that is yet, but I'm kind of looking forward to that, finding my next challenge. So thanks a lot.
Mitch, a feeling that you know, well, have experienced once. The morning after, with you, it was a choreographed retirement, wasn't it? You knew that it was going to be at Paris-Roubaix, perhaps slightly different, but can you remember that feeling, that sensation?
I really can. I went to Roubaix. I didn't finish Roubaix, and then we went back to the hotel, and I had sort of, I got up early. I remember waking up early, and I was staying at not my team hotel. I was staying at my at the Green Edge Hotel. So I went back and sort of partied on with those boys, and all the EF boys sort of went home. So Durbo said to me, come back and stay at our hotel. So I stayed at my old hotel, Leppel Bed, just outside of Ghent in Mellor. I woke up and I walk up to the front room early, and I sort of had this time to myself. It wasn't probably that early compared to these days, at 8 o'clock in the morning, but pro hours, it was super early. And I was sitting in the front room, and I really had this release, this feeling like this weight was off my shoulders. When you know it's time, it feels like a weight. And where, however long that is, you know, for me, it was from the Roubaix, you know, the normal Roubaix time. So April onwards, I'd made the announcement. And even though, because I was talking to Simon Geschke over at Tour Down Under this year, I said, you're going to have some great moments this year because there's stuff in races that you hate, but you can weirdly flip it and enjoy it. You're like, oh, this is the last time I'll have to do this crosswind sector in an Eco Tour or Bing Bank or whatever the hell the name is now. You know, you're like, how cool is this? I'll never be back in this crap. So there are moments like that you can enjoy, but there was this weight that got lifted off my shoulder. I distinctly remember that morning being like, oh, it's done. How nice is this? You know? But of course, then, you know, it's followed very soon after to the scariness of like, what next? You know, what now? So that comes soon after. But I definitely had a moment of like, yeah, this is nice. This is cool. I'm done.
Very different. People always talk about going out on their own terms. And that scenario you just described of knowing that it's going to be your last, you know, crosswind section at the Eneco Tour or whatever, that applies to someone who's announced or at least got it clear in their own mind that they are going to retire on a certain date. Joe's situation is more of a sort of hybrid, I would suggest. I mean, I've been speaking to him throughout the winter where at times, well, he was certainly keen to find another team. I think he didn't feel that it was a matter of life or death. He was sort of reconciled to the idea that he might have to retire and was okay with that. And yeah, having heard from him this morning and been speaking to him over the last few weeks, I think he does feel slightly disoriented. And so it's interesting to hear you say that going out on your own terms was important, because that is something that's often mentioned. I mean, even I'm thinking of Mark Cavendish now and all the sort of speculation and debate about whether he should, shouldn't do another year. And that was one of the things that has been mentioned in relation to that, that's come up in conversations I've had with members of his entourage. Should he do what you did, in effect?
Well, look, Cavendish is maybe in a different scenario where he can sort of do that. And I think he will always sort of find a contract, whether it'll be the contract he's happy with.
Mm.
Joe maybe in a different scenario where, you know, he probably wasn't willing to ride for nothing, you know. And, you know, to a degree, I read the room early on in the year and went, you know, it could be pretty difficult at the end of this year for me to get another contract. Maybe I could if I scratched around and got something for a very low wage. I think the way I came up with it, whether this was a question or not, was, do I have anything more to achieve? I sort of went, not really. You know, I know I'm not going to win Roubaix as much as I'd love to. That's probably out of my realm. Have I sort of done everything that I'd hoped, and am I happy with it? Again, I didn't win Roubaix. I didn't, you know, win the Tour de France. I didn't ride the Tour de France. So there were some things that I was sort of like, cool, but I realized that probably wasn't going to happen in the next year with one last contract. So I was like, I'm actually pretty happy where I'm at. Why don't I try and go out on my own terms rather than get to October and then realize it's sort of forced on me? So sort of got ahead of the eight ball early on. And I think the change of the date of Roubaix really suited me, because it was like, I ultimately can finish with my favorite race no matter what happens. And that was a really nice scenario for me. And it really, even though the race got taken from me, it just showed me the light. I was like, you know what? This is it. You can't have it any better than this, mate. You can finish on your favorite race. So it doesn't happen like that for a lot of people, because, you know, as you described with Joe, I don't actually know Joe's story. I'd be interested to hear how that's sort of formulated. But you can come to the end of the year very quickly and realize, shit, I haven't got something. And, you know, teams are sort of waiting for you. And this scenario, this is something, when I say the weight off your shoulders, this is something I do not miss. I do not miss this, living on the edge of your seat year in, year out, or even at the very luxury of 2 years. So that's something that Joe will certainly love moving into that next phase.
Yeah, one thing, there've been a few riders this winter who have been in this situation that I've sort of had a bit of a running conversation with, and the doubt as well about whether, I mean, to put it bluntly, whether your agent is speaking to the right people and having the right conversations, and just that question mark. Is there a team out there who I'm not aware of who might take me if, for example, I present my case in the right way, or my agent does? And I can imagine that that is a bit of a head scratcher.
Yeah, we also mentioned before in another pod, but and you, I think you, Daniel, mentioned the fact that the average age in the World Tour is going down every year. And when you pass 30 these days, is it becoming more and more difficult to find a team? When we have, we'll discuss, you know, the new Mexican superstars, you know, the new sensation of world cycling. But every year there's more and more young guys coming in. And is that a problem for the older ones? I don't know. It's just a question. I don't have the answer to that. But my impression at the moment is that there's a tendency to hire more, you know, younger guys and to get rid of the older guys, you know, in spite of their experience. I mean, Boisson Hagen being an exception, obviously.
I mean, look at you, Francois. We've kicked you out of our Tour de France podcast. Right?
Yeah, absolutely. No, I went on my own journey.
Yeah, he totally did.
Yeah, the viscous with my Paris-Roubaix. Yeah.
Your own Michelin-starred terms. Chaps, I was just going to mention one more thing in the news roundup before we conclude part one. About a week ago, La Gazzetta dello Sport did something that they do pretty much every year, where they produced a list of professional cycling's top earners, with Tadej Pogacar number one, €6 million. Primoz Roglic, 4.5 in second place. Jonas Vingegaard, €4 million. Mathieu van der Poel, €4 million. Wout van Aert, €3.5 million. Remco Evenepoel, €2.8 million. Tom Pidcock, €2.7 million. Adam Yates, €2.7 million. Egan Bernal, €2.5 million. And Carlos Rodriguez, €2.5 million. Jonathan Vaughters tweeted that this was basically all nonsense. It does tickle me as well that particularly La Gazzetta always publishes a list of this nature every year, based, I'm pretty sure, on a lot of speculation. They will be having conversations with agents. Agents aren't the best source in these cases because obviously it's in their interest to suggest, I don't know, their riders are earning more than they are or not earning as much as they are. And it just reminds me, chaps, I sort of got a peek behind the curtain of one of these features being written for a different media outlet many years ago at the Tour de France. I think it was the 2004 Tour de France. One of our colleagues, you both know him. I'm not going to give his name. We'll call him Bruce. Bruce, one day at the Tour de France, one day in the press room, I could see him sort of shuffling along the pews in the Tour de France press room. And he was asking everyone pretty much the same question. He was just giving sort of riders' names. Oh, Menchov. How much do you think Menchov earns? How much do you think Contador earns? And so on and so on. And he got to me and I said, so Bruce, what's this for? And he said, oh, I'm just doing an article, Freebs, about the top earners in the sport. Anyway, I saw this particular journalist a day or so later in the Start Village looking pretty downcast. And I said, what's wrong, Bruce? And he said, oh, that article didn't go down too well. And apparently Matt White, another good friend of the podcast, who I think was writing for Cofidis that year, had seen Bruce on the other side of the Start Village that morning and shouted out to him words to the effect of, Bruce, where did you get those figures from, mate? Out of your ass. a pretty fair representation of how these stories are often created. But it did make me think, Mitch, how much awareness is there of what other guys are earning in the peloton? No. Is it different to any other job? I suspect it's probably similar to other jobs where you might know, you might have a colleague who is quite open about these things and will tell you, and others who will never tell you.
It's very much like that. And I think as you go on, I was going to mention this about the managers before, as you go on, you sort of need a manager less and less because you start to understand what you're worth. Early on, I think managers are very good for riders because they actually don't know how much they're worth and how much they can go for. And, oh, wow, I'm worth that? Great. If we can get that, awesome. And at the end of your career, you sort of go, you know what, I probably can't get that. You know, I probably can't get this. So let's try and go in the middle. And I think also, this is slightly off the wage, is that I think you can pitch yourself better at the end of your career to go back on the experience role. I just don't think managers pitch the experience role well enough. They keep saying what the riders can and can't do. Yeah, this guy's that. And it's like, as a rider, you're like, cool, look, I know sort of what I can do. What you need to sell me is what I can do off the bike, what I can add to the team off the bike and in the race as a captain, as the experience. I don't think that story gets told well enough from the manager's side of things. They're more just like, look, he can win this race, or he can do the classics, or he can do this in the tour. You know, and obviously most teams go, well, he hasn't done that for 10 years, so we know that's bullshit. But they just keep pushing that out. But when it comes to wages, especially my own experience, towards the end of my career, let's say the last 3 or 4 years, most of the negotiations I did myself, when it came to the final dealings of the contracts and that, I was like, cool, handball it to my manager. I didn't want to do that. But I think that personal touch was more important when you're speaking to teams.
Yeah, one person that is probably happy about the story is probably Patrick Lefebvre, because, you know, with Evenepoel earning, you know, at least twice less than twice less than Pogacar and almost twice less than Vingegaard, shows that, you know, the reputation of stinginess from Patrick is deserved, and, you know, he manages the team tight, which is...
Lionel, a long time no... I'm not going to say see... because I did see you recently, even in person as well as virtually. I've seen rather a lot of you virtually recently.
I bought you a snowflake oat milkaccino, Daniel, lest you forget.
You did.
Happy New Year, by the way.
Yeah, went down a treat as well. Happy New Year to you, Lionel. Lionel, since we've got you here, there have been a few questions, not only in the last week, but over the last few weeks, few months, about you and the podcast. You've not been... hosting the podcast as often as was once the case. I believe that you'd like to share something today with the listeners.
Well, yeah, I think we should be open and transparent with the listeners who've supported us, some of them, since the very beginning, 10 years ago. Yeah, I intended to have a break over the winter, and over the winter, over Christmas really, I came to a decision And that is having spent 21...
You didn't want to do the podcast with me anymore. No. And you're delivering this message from under the floorboards in my house in an orange boiler suit.
No, it doesn't relate to you at all, Daniel. It's got nothing to do with you. It's purely a decision that I've made, having spent 21 of the past 25 summers away from home covering the Tour de France. I don't want to do that this year. I've decided it's time for a change of focus.
So you're going to do the Giro and the Vuelta this year?
I'm putting down the mic. I'm passing on the mic. I'm passing on the mic. Now, that doesn't mean that my commitment to the cycling podcast is going to be diminished in any way. In fact, I think it will help me to focus my energies in a more constructive way, behind the scenes, I suppose. I found it quite difficult splitting my focus between the journalism side of what we do, the most important thing, which is the podcast and what we put out. But there has been, quite a significant development over 10 years, building what has become a business, a company, and that requires maintenance and work and focus as well. And I just can't split my brain in two. And I find it hard to go from one to the other. I find it hard to try and do both at once. And so I feel that in order to be more effective and in order to kind of reduce some of my own internal conflict and tension about my working life, I need to focus on one thing or the other. And I've chosen to step back into the shadows somewhat. I'll be in HQ, counting the bidons and stacking them neatly, making sure the logos all face out in the right way. And rather than just kind of take a year off from the Tour de France or a period off from the Tour de France, I feel that it's better for the cycling podcast and better for the listeners if we pass the microphone on and create a new team. That won't happen if I'm kind of hogging one of the seats, I feel. That's my decision. I'm going to step behind the curtain, Daniel, but we'll still talk regularly. I mean, daily, probably.
Well, Lionel, we'll get back to my other co-host for this week in just a minute, but I think what you're saying is that you're not targeting the Giro and the Vuelta instead of the Tour. That's not what you're announcing. You're also not announcing that you are leaving the cycling podcast to start, I don't know, the ski jumping podcast, doing a reverse Roglic. Lionel, I'm sure the listeners might have some more questions. You are going to maybe address some of the questions they will have in the 1 minute past 11 cappuccino, the newsletter on Substack this week. Some of our listeners might want to put questions, comment on your post with questions. You can ask me questions on Twitter, X. I won't guarantee that I'll answer all of them, particularly those that are, if they're impertinent or impolite, I won't answer them. But we will try to be as transparent as possible about what's going to happen over the next few months.
Yeah, there's obviously been a lot of change over the last couple of years on the cycling podcast. We want to ensure that as it evolves, it remains true to the founding spirit, really, which is friends who happen to be journalists talking about cycling, or journalists who happen to be friends, whichever way you want to look at it. And so this isn't an end of anything. This is a new beginning. We've been active in the January transfer window, haven't we, Daniel? We'll have some plans to announce shortly. And as I say, if you do have a question about the cycling podcast, drop us a line. Look out for the 1101 cappuccino, or drop us a line, contact@thecyclingpodcast.com. Thank you everyone who has sent a comment my way. All of your comments have been deeply appreciated over the years, and I'm not going to be a complete stranger. I will still be here at the Cycling Podcast HQ. If you need any bidons counting, Daniel.
Or ads reading. So, gentlemen, we have already talked about some of the racing in the last few days, some of the racing in Spain, for example. Of course, the main event of the last week or so was the Tour Down Under, first event on both the Women's World Tour calendar and the men's. Just a quick recap, the women's race was won by Sarah Gigante of AG Insurance Sudal. She won the last stage, or the decisive stage, on Willunga Hill. Is it Willunga Hill, Mitch, or Old Willunga Hill?
Willunga, yeah, Willunga Hill, oh. But just say Willunga.
Okay. Why do I think Old Willunga Hill?
I think it actually is the old Wollonga Hill. I don't know why. I think there's another way up there, a main road, and that's probably the old, that's the old road up, but no one would refer to it as the old Wollonga.
Okay. Anyway, Sarah Gigante won there, and which wrapped up the GC for her. Other stage winners in the women's race were Cecily Utrup-Ludwig of FDJ Suez and Ali Wollaston of AG Insurance Sudal. The men's stage winners, I'll go the stage winners first. Sam Welsford won the first stage. Isaac Del Toro, more about him later. Sam Welsford won the third stage and the fourth stage. And then we got into the last two, the hilly decisive stages. They were won by Oscar Onley. And then Stephen Williams won the last stage on Mount Lofty, which gave him victory overall for Israel Premier Tech. Mitch, you were there, as you are always at the Tour Down Under, as previously discussed. I said in my intro that it was golden and a delicious addition. General consensus, I've not been to the Tour Down Under, but general consensus among the people I speak to is that Stuart O'Grady, as race director, he's been race director for a couple of years now, is doing a good job there, and this event is one that continues to grow and thrive.
You guys would absolutely love the press room. There is a fridge with ice cream in it. There's another fridge with an assortment of drinks, beer, wine. They bring in pizza. I was like, this is ridiculous. There's Wi-Fi, free Wi-Fi, and it's in the bottom of the Hilton. It was there's a barista there purely for the press room, making coffees. Like, nothing more to be said about TDU. That's done. It's fun. The being a press, whatever you want to call it, a media person there working on, you know, a journalist, dare I say I'm that. But going into the start, Village is super fun. There's like three of you in there and you just cruise around. And anytime the riders want to get away from you, they're in these vans and you literally walk up to the window and just knock, knock, knock. And they look across you and you're like, interview? And they're like, God, all right. You know, you don't have to deal with the press officers. You don't have to deal with the buses with the mirror windows. It's brilliant. So you guys are missing out. The race itself, let's just, before we get to the race, the special thing about Down Under is it's in Adelaide, obviously, but it's in the Hilton. It's one spot. So all these festival vibes build up around the city. And people try and ask me, is it the same as the Tour? I'm like, so different of the Tour, because, you know, I've only ever been on the other side of the fence, and the Tour moves. It's the rolling, you know, the rolling show. The show rolls on, everyone's there, you're moving around. And it's great when you're there in that town, but TDU, especially with the brands, they build up these pop-ups and they've got events going every night. And the riders, because it's early season, we had Sam Welsford, after he won his final stage, on his birthday, pop into a live interview that we had, you know, an hour after the stage finish. So I was just spruiking it up, going, we've got Sam Welsford tonight coming into the map specialised pop-up. It's like, when could this ever happen in another race? I can't think of another race where this happens. The crowds are super awesome. Anyone who's around just loves it and froths off the atmosphere. So it's a big pitch for TDU, but it really is a really, really fun week and worthwhile. And there's heaps of cyclists there. When it gets to the race, for me, I do find the race quite boring in terms of it is an early season race and there's not guns firing. And the one day, for me anyway, that where fireworks could have gone, the stage from Murray Bridge, there was no wind. So that became a boring sort of sprint stage. But I think Stuart O'Grady's doing an awesome thing, which he added in this year, the Wollonga Hill, which traditionally used to be the final deciding stage. He put in the Mount Lofty stage, which last year featured as the final stage. They took Wollonga Hill out. This year they added both. So Saturday you had Wollonga Hill. Then Sunday you had the Mount Lofty. So it wasn't done and dusted at Wollonga on Saturday. And we used to come in and do a ceremonial crit on the Sunday. And now it was Lofty. Like, you know, you still have to defend the title of Mount Lofty. I think the women's race too was a really good addition. Really exciting coming into Wollonga Hill. I really enjoyed that as well. And again, we were able to tap into interviewing Sarah Gigante. We had the whole AG Insurance team there as well, plus the Life Plus Wahoo girls there. So it's just a great access to the riders, not only for me as a journalist, but for the fans. You get to see these guys. They go on all the rides with the sponsors. They're mixing in It's a super good atmosphere, and it's a really, I asked the riders, a lot of them, one of my questions I asked them, which will be coming up on my own podcast at Talking Luft, why is it good starting the season out here at Tour Down Under? Like, what's the benefit? And they all said it. It's the obvious things. The weather, you know, the one hotel, the relaxed atmosphere, even though it doesn't seem half as relaxed when I did it, but even though comparative to what the other races are, they get an element of it is a toned-down version and there's a race at the end. But that comes back to Stuart O'Grady, understanding being a rider and understanding what they need, not putting an uphill start in the beginning of the season, not putting epic stages, understanding there still needs to be exciting racing, but keeping it in the back end. So I agree with you. Stewie's done an awesome job taking over from Mike Turda.
Mitch, you mentioned there the sort of softish. They contrive to have a softish start to the season. The stages aren't too long. The Willunga Hills, I think 3.4 kilometers. Mount Lofty is not a long climb either. But does that mean, and this will bring us on to some of the sort of stars and star performances of the week, that one should be careful of interpreting this race with one's Tour Down Under goggles on, i.e. reading too much into this race? Either the sprints, because the sprints, you might say they're quite different from some of the sprints that the peloton will face in a few weeks' time in Europe. You know, the roads are wide in Australia, in the Tour Down Under. You know, Sam Welsford winning three stages here does not necessarily mean that he's going to be the dominant sprinter. And then, you know, that applies as well to some of the climbing performances and the GC performances we may have seen the last few days. Isaac Del Toro is not necessarily the next Tadej Pogacar. But generally speaking, do you think there is a danger that we read too much into what happens at this race?
Yes and no. I know they're sitting on the fence, but look, I would say that yes a few years ago. But I think the importance of every single race these days, and you know, the Tour Down Under, you know, gaining points and just getting a win up, it's much harder to do what, you know, Stevie Williams did and even what Welsford did. You know, Caleb Ewan, he wants to start with green edge on the right foot, and no one was gifting any victories there. Viviani as well, you know, Ineos were lining it out, and I got to give credit to the Bora train. That is a well drilled train. And I think they started the season well. And I believe that they will go on and do great things this year because of that train with Mullen and also Van Poppel. If you take Welsford out of it, his performance was amazing as well. But if you look at how well that train was drilled and the performance they did and how well they stuck together, I think they're going to go on to do great things this year throughout the season with Sam. Sam's rolling in now with huge confidence. But he's got that raw power. You saw it. He was able to step out, go mano a mano against Caleb Ewan and just put him away cleanly. So as we know, Caleb Ewan's no, you know, he's no, what's the word I'm looking for? He's no amateur. He's no, you know, slog. He knows what to do. So I was really impressed with that. When it comes to Del Toro, I thought he was going to walk away with this. I was like, that's it. That stage was, again, like, what? The, you know, Israel is doing this lead out for Corbin Strong. He and the guys are just doing peelers. He steps off them like they're just like me riding out there doing my ride across to Adelaide. So that was, it was quite surprising for me that he didn't feature in those as much as I thought in those final two stages. I got caught up in the hype as well, but I wouldn't underestimate these results. Let's rewind sort of 5, maybe even 10 years ago. Yes, 100% agree with you. Don't get too carried away with this, but things have changed.
Remember the addition when Greipel won? How many stages was it? 6 or 7 stages. That was his sort of first, that was his arrival on the world stage. Mm. And in fairness, he did deliver on that over the next 2 or 3 years.
Do you know how many stages he's won of Tour Down Under?
Lots, I would suggest. Lots.
18. He's the most, 18. He's got the most stages of Down Under.
Cobber.
So it, yes, it's gone up a notch for sure. It's definitely gone up a notch, but the good thing about it is O'Grady has kept it to its true tradition of Tour Down Under. Let's not get too carried away. Let's make it hard enough, but let's keep it still a first race of the season.
Unfortunately, I've never been to the Tour Down Under. I was invited a couple of times but it just didn't fit into my season. I was doing a lot of skiing at the time, so I couldn't be at both the skiing in Europe and Tour Down Under. But I think, as you say, it's probably great that a tour like that and with that kind of atmosphere is at the start of the World Tour, because it reminds me what you're telling me of another pretty young event, which is the Canadian Grand Prix in Quebec and Montreal, where you have also one hotel, easy access to the riders, and the fact that from a lot of riders is the last race of the season because they're not going to the Worlds or they're not going to the World Cup. Well, obviously because they're there, means you've got a different atmosphere, a more relaxed atmosphere. And in the same time, that there are events like the Tour Down Under, that there was lots of doubts and skepticism when they were launched, and now their place in the World Tour is not disputed anymore. I mean, so to start in Australia, finish in Canada with different continents, different atmosphere, I think is great for the sport. And also, I mean, Stephen Williams, the guys who win this type of races, like Stephen Williams, there are guys what did Williams win the Tour of Norway last year? I seem to remember. I mean, the Arctic race. Well, I mean, these are the Williams is the type of rider that to win that sort of events, and of course he will probably never win a Grand Tour. But this I think that's fine. I mean, there's you need this kind of 1 week event, designed for this type of riders, at a special moment in the season. And I always follow the Tour Down Under with great interest. I think it gives clues, to what's going to happen in the rest of the season. Maybe not on the classics, or maybe not on the Grand Tours. But if you look at the World Tour calendar, at large, yes, I think it gives indications of what to expect.
Well, it was an incredible win by Stephen Williams, chaps. I mean, this is a rider who, if you remember, had an absolutely catastrophic first season as a professional rider. He'd had a brilliant last year as an amateur, 2018, in races like the Baby Giro, and then turned pro with Bahrain Merida, I think they were called at that time. I think he did 8 race days in his first year, had one of these knee injuries that no one could diagnose properly, and they eventually got to the bottom of it. He had a part of a bone, or a bone, the fabella bone, removed. But at the end of his first 2 years at Bahrain Merida, I would suggest that had he not been in a team managed by a British coach, Rod Ellingworth, British director sportif, he might have fallen off the edge of the earth as far as professional cycling is concerned. Rod gave him another contract, another 2 years, and well, he's demonstrated certainly since then that he very much belongs at the top level. Won in places like Croatia, won a stage of the Tour of Switzerland last year as well. And one of you mentioned points. That was a vital, well, it was a brilliant week for Israel Premier Tech as far as UCI points are concerned. They're a team that's obviously, it's been relegated once already, and it's very much in the sort of fight to get promoted again. Francois, I was going to ask you, I was going to throw you this hot potato. Israel Premier Tech, obviously, this is a team that sort of is a kind of de facto national team as far as their owner is concerned. Sylvain Adams wants them to represent Israel. We are, of course, in the midst of a war in the Middle East between Israel and, well, Hamas. And very difficult to know how to approach this topic. The riders themselves, there isn't a single rider on Israel Premier Tech, I would suggest, who would not want the fighting to stop, the war to stop. We've said many times that these riders, unfortunately, and this applies to a lot of the sponsors in the World Tour, they are sort of pawns and they don't have a lot of choice a lot of the time. It's not as though they can choose any World Tour team to represent. There are a couple of them. Pogacar, Vingegaard could represent any team, but most of them have to go where there is a spot, where there is a possibility to ride. So you know, they are not sort of diplomats in tracksuits, to use a term that used to be used in East Germany, of their own volition, but they do have Israel on their jersey. There's been a bit of talk in the last couple of weeks about what's going to happen with Israel at the Olympics, for example, in Paris this year, whether the same sanctions should be placed on Israel as have been placed on Russia, for example, as a result of what's happening in the Middle East. Francois, what are your feelings when you see an Israel Premier Tech rider winning a race like this? And how do you think they might feel about it?
It's, well, not funny, but what's interesting is if you look at the World Tour the way it was before the war broke up, it was kind of the Abraham agreements between the some of the Emirates and Israel. Remember that before Hamas struck, you know, Israel was on the verge of signing an agreement with Saudi Arabia and had already signed deals and peace treaties with some of the Arabic countries around. And in the cycling World Tour, you had Israel and you had the UAE and Bahrain. I mean, it was kind of a reflection of the state of the world at that stage, which was that, yeah, you could have two teams, you know, represented, Emirates, and also a team representing Israel, and all those teams competing together, you know, which in itself was already, and we probably never saw it this way enough, but was kind of a
hopeful message in a way, yeah.
Yeah, it was a hopeful message, but when you think that in football, Israel play in the European zone because to avoid playing in the Asian zone for a long time. So there was a political issue that cycling maybe unwittingly had solved. Does the new situation change anything? I really don't think that from my point of view, from the point of view of the fan, and probably from the point of view of the riders, and from the point of view of a lot of people into cycling, never really saw UAE Team Emirates as the national team of the Emirates or Bahrain. It sounds like it's just sponsors in a way, you know. And I don't think Israel Premier Tech was ever seen. Maybe it's seen by its owners as a flagship.
That's the thing with this team. This team, people might see the name and think that it is a government organ or entirely sponsored by the government. That's not the case. I mean, Sylvain Adams has been on record to say that the team gets a pitiful amount from the Israeli government, and this is really his kind of passion project. He feels very strongly about Israel and the role that it played, for example, for his family in the lives of his family, and consequently he wants to tell the world what an incredible place Israel is.
In the same time, if he wanted to make life easier for himself, he'd just take Israel out of the team name and calls it Premier Tech, and nobody would care, you know, that it's an Israeli team it's Israeli or Canadian or whatever you want to call it. But anyway, and about Israel and the Olympics, I mean, we're going a little bit away, but you mentioned that, in my opinion, given the IOC policy, if I say on politics generally, it's very, very rare that IOC actually ban a country. I mean, they're very conservative towards that. And in the same time, the French government is supporting Israel in the same time by asking for a two-state solution. So I really can't see, you know, Israel being banned from the Olympics. I mean, to me, there's a 0.5% chance of that happening anyway.
The Russian foreign minister, Sergei Lavrov, recently, well, he highlighted the disparity as he sees it between the treatment of Russia. He called it an outrageous disparity between the way IOC has treated Russia and the way they are not treating Israel.
There were doping issues as well with Russia. I mean, yeah. Of course you have the invasion of Ukraine, but before that, the Sochi, doping scandal was one of the greatest state, monitored doping scandal ever. I don't think Israel has had, doping issues in the past. I mean, to that extent. So, I mean, Lavrov has been, well, of course, diplomatic, but also a little bit hypocritical there.
Mitch, we're going to move on from this, but I just wanted to ask you whether you think there'd be any sort of queasiness on the part of the riders. You know, you're good friends, I think, with, well, for example, Sam Bewley, who's the director sportif at Down Under last week, and various other members of that team. This is, as I said, this is a position a lot of riders currently find themselves in. They're representing whether it's a state or a company with, you know, some question marks, some more than others, by their name, by their reputation. I think I mentioned before on the podcast, I had a conversation with a rider about a year ago who rides for one of these teams and sort of asked my opinion about it. And I said, the best thing you could probably do is try to inform yourself, read as much as possible, and then see if it alters the your feeling about riding for this team, riding with their name on your jersey, and then, you know, take action from there. And of course, as I said initially, that sort of presupposes that the riders has options to go elsewhere. I mean, there aren't too many places in the World Tour at the moment where you can go, where there isn't some sort of whiff of sport washing. But do you think the riders think about this, or do you think on the whole they try to block this out?
Yeah, like, even if they're aware of it, to be honest, I think a lot of riders are really just in their own world. I think the DS is a bit different. You know, being older, more sort of matured and understand what the sponsors sort of entail, and, you know, what, you know, like even Mike Woods, you know, last year he was, or even now still, he's really trying to go, you know, carbon free and make some moves, you know, make some big statements and things like that. Just becoming a bit more aware of what we're doing in the cycling world, and, you know, it's a bit more than the racing, and you can get super absorbed in just like being at the top, peak performance, and whatever. I don't care who sponsors me. If that is a company, is that, you know, we were sponsored by Orica, you know, in Green Edge. You know, this is a massive, you know, mining explosives company. And for whatever reason, they decided to sponsor, you know, Green Edge to clean up their image. I don't know what exactly that was all about. But, you know, you just sort of you rolled with it. You're like, yeah, sweet, we got Orica on a jersey, you know. But you weren't that aware of it as a young guy. And as you get older, you become more aware of what the world is, and a bit more sort of exactly what you said, just becoming a bit more educated about it and able to answer questions about it and have your own education around it. Look, I think I'm going to speak on behalf of my mates that you spoke about, Sam Bewley and, you know, Darrell Impey and George Bennett. I know these guys are at that point in their career and they are certainly more educated about it, but the younger guys, I don't know, you know, even like a guy like Nick Schiltz, he's a bit younger, so, you know, maybe they're still in that point of their career, like, great, you know, I've got a team and they're paying me and, you know, I could be out of here in a year's time. So that's just sort of how it is.
And in this particular case, there's the added difficulty of the yawning disparity between what one side in this war is saying and reporting about the reality of events and what the other side is saying. And as a sort of humble observer, sitting in another continent or being a professional bike rider, it's just really, really difficult to establish what the facts are and then to make your decisions on the basis of that. Well, chaps, we have covered some of the main stories from the Tour Down Under, the winner of the race, the star sprinter of the race. We didn't talk about his moustache, Mitch. Looks as though it could have been inspired by yours. But I know this is a common look in Australia, isn't it? More common than in other parts of the world.
Wow, look at Bottas now. He's I was at the sideline. I got a funny story for you. I was at the sideline. The stage two finish of the women's, it was up in, it was not far from Stirling, or maybe it was in Stirling. It was up there doing a pub crawl, actually. Shout out to my own Life in the Peloton pub crawl. And we said, you know what, the women's race is finishing down the road. Let's go look at it. This guy came up shaking my hand. Oh, I can't believe I'm seeing you here. And blah, blah, blah. And then like halfway through the conversation, he's like talking about this gravel event and he's talking about car racing. And I'm like, mate,
who is this guy?
I just hit him with it. Like, who do you think I am? And he's like, oh, you're Bottas. And I'm like, nah, mate, I'm not.
Oh, I thought you were going to say that was Bottas sort of fanboying you then.
This guy was like, and then I'm like, he's like, oh, so then who are you? And I was like, well, I'm no one, mate. He's like, oh, yeah, see ya. And he just turns his back and walks off. And I was like, mate, he copied me. I was the original. He just walked off. He was done. I was no one to him. So the mullet and the mo, it's coming back strong. I'm not going to say I was the first, but, you know, I want to say one of the first in the peloton.
There's a question, to you know, about the aerodynamics of the moustache. I mean, does a moustache create slipstream or something, or does it create an unfair advantage when you sprint? There should be a study on the research.
Oh, the UCI is going to come down on that for sure, Francois. For sure.
Well, we've now covered moustaches as well. We've covered Welsford. We've covered Williams. We're going to move on now to the rider who was the revelation of the race. Stage winner, 19-year-old stage winner, Isaac Del Toro of UAE Team Emirates. And this felt like a big moment, chaps. The way he took his stage win in a manner we don't often see these days, sort of kind of finishers attack in the last, was the last 3 or 4 kilometers of a hilly stage. So it sort of demonstrated an explosive speed and also his ability to climb. This rider was also the winner of the Tour de l'Avenir last year, which, as we know, has a fantastic record of sort of showcasing the coming men in professional cycling. So a bit was already known about Isaac Del Toro. A little bit more is known now. Chaps, before we discuss him, I did try to find out a little bit more about Isaac Del Toro from one of his compatriots earlier in the week. Goga Ruiz Sandoval is a commentator on cycling. She commentates on cycling for Colombian TV, Caracol. She lives in the United States. However, Goga is Mexican. I've known her for a number of years now, so I thought she was ideally placed to tell us a bit about her compatriot, Isaac Del Toro, starting with where he's from in Mexico. So here is Goga.
Ensenada is a border town. It has had not such a good reputation sometimes because of that. You know, there's bad commerce and crossing from Mexico to the U.S. But in the last 15 years, it's been a better place to live. It's a town that is proud because they are connecting pass-through to the United States. It has these problems, you know, because there's violence sometimes. Border towns in Mexico, they are a little bit chaotic. But nowadays, they are better. It's not a common place to find an athlete, an elite athlete. In this case, it is.
Yeah. Looking at the history of Mexican cyclists and the ones who have had success, there doesn't seem to be any real sort of geographical kind of hotspot or fulcrum of the cycling movement in Mexico, in the sense that they've come from kind of everywhere. Raul Alcalá was from near Monterrey, I think. Miguel Arroyo was from near Mexico City, I believe. But is there any particular region where cycling has a sort of strong culture and a strong following in Mexico? Has there been historically?
It's mostly in the middle of the country, not so much in the north. There has been some good cyclists in the north. They are strong and a good height. Most of those athletes go to the United States to race. Example of that is Eder Fraire. He's doing good in the States, but it's in the middle of the country where you can find like a huge culture around the cycling culture. León, Querétaro, those states in Mexico, they have a lot of cyclists. Tlaxcala is another one, the birth town of Miguel Arroyo. Sometimes you can find some good athletes in Jalisco, in Michoacán. Those are more towards the Pacific side of the country. But there's not like you would find in Colombia. There's two regions. In Mexico, you can find a lot of places, but mostly from the center part to the north.
When I first heard of Isaac Del Toro last year and he won the Tour de l'Avenir, I hoped, Goga, that he was going to be from somewhere he was going to be born 2,200 meters above sea level. And then I looked at where he was born, and it was at 0 meters above sea level. How long have you known about him, and how surprised have you been?
I found out about the project where he came from 3 years ago, because we in Mexico, we don't have any federation, as you know. There's been a little efforts, but not like big efforts, but small ones that bring some of these athletes to have some kind of schedule, if you will. But this sponsor, Remonex, they decided to take 8 or 10, I think it was, riders from 14, 15, 16 years old, and they took them to Europe, mostly to race in Belgium and Italy. They stay there in San Marino. Isaac del Toro is the first one that comes out from this effort that it's not as known in Mexico, because before Isaac, we didn't have any other example, recent example. I know in Mexico, there's a lot of fans for pro cycling, you know, as everybody else in the world. But it's right now, this is making a commotion, really. I knew he was good. He has above average height for a Mexican cyclist. I didn't know how strong his mentality was. And that's what has impressed me the most, because he's 19 or 20, and you know that physically he can probably do a lot of things, but mentally is the most impressive thing that I can say. He analyzes a lot of races. He doesn't have any doubts. He's very proactive, and I think that shows right now, and that shows while he was growing up with this project.
When he won his stage in the Tour Down Under, did it create any kind of splash, or was there much interest? Has there been much interest in the last few days?
Yeah, of course. I am still friends with a lot of journalists in Mexico, and they had forgotten about cycling a long time ago. But I know it has caused a little commotion, because he's young, and we knew about some results from last year, so it was not like out of the blue. Some people that follow cycling, they knew who he was already because of the Bio Giro and the Tour del Avenir. It's going to happen the same as it happens in Colombia sometimes. If you only have good results, then you will be covered. But if not, you will tend to be a little bit forgotten. This is good for Mexico. The first example that we have in a long time, so younger cyclists will be looking to see what can they do. And Remonex, they are still growing. I would hope that they understand that they can become just like the other teams that provide cyclists to the World Tour, like the other American teams, that they bring some cyclists to the World Tour.
Raul Alcala was the best Mexican cyclist ever, I guess most people would agree. He finished, I think, in the top 10 of the Tour 3 times and won stages in the Tour. How big did cycling become in Mexico in those years, in the 80s? Or how much did people follow him?
When I started doing this thing as a journalist, he was my inspiration. He was the pretext that I had with my bosses to go cover cycling. He was an idol in Mexico. We had a lot of big races in Mexico in those years, in the first part of the 90s. He and Miguel Arroyo, that was a little bit younger, they moved masses. It was incredible. I remember covering the Ruta Mexico in those years. They had a lot of support from the Mexican government, and they had a lot of budget, so they could bring the biggest stars of those years. I remember one of those races, they brought Greg LeMond, they brought Gianni Buño. There were some big stars in those years, and I hope I can find some pictures and I can send it to you. for so you see, but it was massive. It was just like you see right now in Colombia. It was great.
So, fellas, our breakout performance from Isaac del Toro. We see these every now and again. We've seen more and more of them over the last few years. That the ages have got younger. Francois, you mentioned earlier on in the podcast this sort of trend of teams looking for younger and younger riders. I had a look a few days ago after Del Toro's stage win at the number of riders aged under 23 who have won World Tour races or top level World Tour and HC races in every season since about the year 2000. If you go back to seasons like the year 2000, there were maybe I think one or two riders in the year 2000 under the age of 23 won World Tour or HC races. If you look at the last couple of years, the average is around 22-23 riders under the age of 23 per year are winning World Tour and HC races. But it did make me think, chaps, we can probably all remember some of the names, some of these performances we've seen. And I feel as when you're a younger sort of journalist or younger observer of the sport, these performances have a bigger impact, and you have a tendency to extrapolate even more sort of extravagantly and think that, you know, this 20-year-old that's won this stage of Étoile de Bessèges is going to win 15 Tours de France. And then with a bit of age and experience, you realise that that's not always how it pans out. I remembered a few, Francois, I remembered when Thomas Löfqvist, 20-year-old Thomas Löfqvist, the Swedish rider, won the Circuit de la South in 2004. And that seemed like a seismic moment for the sport. I remember a Russian rider, Mikhail Ignatiev, in riding for Tinkov, a very sort of young Tinkov team, 2007, winning. I think he won Liguellia on the stage of the Tour of the Med in spectacular fashion, and everyone sort of tipping him for multiple Grand Tour victories. These were riders who never got anywhere near a Grand Tour victory. We hope that things are different for Isaac del Toro, but can you chaps remember any sort of performances from very young riders that really struck you and caused you to prognosticate fantastic success for them?
Well, Miguel Indurain. but he did deliver, you know. I saw him win the Tour de Vaucluse when he was like very young, and I thought, oh, this guy is great. And unfortunately, well, he went to do lots of big things in the future, but only remember because you know all about him, Jan Ulrich. I remember Bernard Hinault, the world champion of bad predictions, you know, saying that Ulrich would win 7 Tour de France. And the thing is, it kind of goes up and down, but there was this tradition, or even me, I was, you know, there was this common sense that was saying that the right age to win a Grand Tour, for instance, was 27, and that's even when I was a runner myself, when I was, you know, a sports guy, the coaches were always telling you, oh, you when you reach 27, that's the age when, you know, you get to the peak.
That is backed up by figures, Francois. I think there's a graphic on Pro Cycling Stats. If you look at there's a sort of bell curve, it's quite clear that 27 is the magic age in terms of UCI points. Yeah,
even promising young riders in up to 10 years ago were doing their first Grand Tour. All the teams were saying, oh, don't go too far, don't overdo it. Then they were like, Indurain is a case. Like, you know, he did the first couple of Tour de France, one stage, and didn't do much else, because the team said, oh, we don't want you to do that. And then comes Bernal, comes Pogacar, and everything changes. But it's the same. Remember, when Quintana won, started to shine, he was pretty young. We said, oh, he's going to win that many tours. And then we said the same with Bernal and with Pogacar. We don't know if Pogacar is going to win any more Grand Tours. Well, we hope he does. But that idea that because you win at a very young age, you're going to win 7 or 8, even for the great guys, is not confirmed by facts. I mean, and then also to put things back into perspective, the greats of the greats, like Fausto Coppi won his first Giro at the age of 20. So it's not like it's really new. What's new is the amount of young guys coming up every year. You have the impression that every Tour de l'Avenir winner is going to win the Tour de France. But if that's the case, we'll have a different Tour de France winner every year.
The funny thing is, I was trying to think of some just then, but the funny thing is you don't remember them because they don't become champions. You know what I mean? I'm like, yeah. Who were those guys? And I'm trying to remember myself now, but they don't come to mind straight away. But
Mitch, has there ever been someone at a training camp where just merely at a training camp on the basis of the first group rides that they've done in a team, you've thought this guy is?
Well, Michael Storer is, and he is still a very big talent. And even Lucas Hamilton. These guys, within the Australian realms, were sort of in that they came to the Green Edge training camps as under 23s, and they were. And Jai Hindley, to a degree, was sort of, I wouldn't say behind them, but not as sort of predicted as to do as much. These guys are and still are very, big talents, but they've just, for whatever reason, haven't gone on. And Jai, on the other hand, has. So. They're two just straight offhand. I remember coming in and Storer, I even rumoured Storer, and his numbers are incredible and he was all over it. And I was just like, well, this guy's going to do something crazy. He has done some great stuff, but maybe not what I initially thought. And even, I think Lucas Hamilton as well, he could do so much more, but there's so many other elements, isn't there?
Yeah, it's going to be really interesting to watch Del Toro. It's going to be interesting to see what kind of rider he develops into because, as I said, in Down Under, he showcased a couple of different abilities. Pogacar-esque in his sort of style, the sort of narrow bars, very sort of dynamic-looking climbing style when he was out of the saddle. Just looking at the Tour de l'Avenir last year, he lost a lot of time. He was riding for the Mexican team. They lost a lot of time in the team time trial, 2 minutes, and gained it back in the high mountains, but he was only third on a very difficult mountain time trial, 11 kilometers at 8%, and the winner of that was Matthew Ricciatello, who's riding for Israel. And yeah, there's been a little bit of hype about him, there's been sort of interest in his performances, but no one's really talking about him as the next multiple Tour de France winner. Del Toro is living in San Marino, chaps, and he's one of his mentors thus far has been Piotr Ugrumov. A very good climber in his day in the early 90s that you will know, Francois. And also Goga in the audio clip we heard there mentioned Raul Alcala, who you will also have covered, Francois.
Yeah, I remember Raul Alcala pretty well because he was with PDM of dubious fame at the time. And it's true that when Raul Alcala started to win races and be impressive, even in the Tour de France, and performing well in time trials when he was seen as a climber in the first place, there were little bits of doubts about his performances and the performances of others in the team at the time. The interesting thing I think about Del Toro and the kind of young riders we see emerging is that they're all rounders. I mean, they used to be you saw great climbers emerge and you saw great sprinters emerge, but these days these young guys who win the Tour de l'Avenir and who perform straight away on the world tour, they seem to be jack of all trades. They seem to be able to do anything. That's what makes them Evenepoel, Pogacar, all these guys. If you have an impression they can win classics, they can win grand tours, they're not specialists anymore. And there's kind of a new breed of riders coming up. They are far more versatile than they used to be. And that's what's interesting, in my opinion.
Chaps, we are going to conclude today's episode by talking about something else. We're going to pivot away from the Tour Down Under just briefly to talk about one team that was at Down Under, competing at Tour Down Under, competing pretty well with the Ecuadorian rider Jonathan Narvaez. And there's been a lot of talk this winter about Ineos Grenadiers and about how they are going to pivot or need to pivot in the coming year. There were a few reports this week pointing out that Dave Brailsford has now officially formally moved away from the team, in the sense that he is no longer team principal. He is now director of sports Ineos. Ineos, as we know, are about to take over a quarter of Manchester United football team. Brailsford hasn't been replaced in the sense that Ineos Grenadiers don't have a team principal now. However, there have been various additions, a bit of a reshuffle. They have a new CEO called John Allott. Mitch, he's one of your countrymen. He's Australian. He first got involved in cycling with Bahrain when it was Bahrain McLaren. As I say, he's going to be CEO of Ineos Grenadiers. And yesterday, that was Tuesday, he spoke to me and a few other members of the media about how he sees the team's short-term, medium-term, long-term future, and also what Brailsford's role is going to be. Let's just hear a little bit of that now.
Dave's the godfather of this team, the founder of the team. It's actually a privilege that we still have him accessible to the team. His role is as director of Ineos Sport, and so he clearly has responsibility across a variety of different sports and performance of all of them, not just cycling, but it speaks highly of the performance of this particular team that the person given responsibility for performance across that very impressive group of other sports teams has come from a cycling background. And I think that cycling itself should actually be proud of that. You know, we've now got somebody from our world, the world of cycling, involved in what is one of the most famous football teams of the world. And I think that says a lot about what cycling's been able to do over the last 10 or 15 years. Our roots play an important part in this, but we are a, you know, performance-first GC team that is looking to innovate and be at the kind of the zenith of this sport. That's always been the case. I think sometimes people mistakenly think that we've had a diffusion of focus, but that's always been the DNA of the team. That's continued from our previous owners into the Ineos ownership, and the ambition is the same. So with that comes an identity that I think certainly to those inside the team is crystal clear. And that is that we're a GC team first and foremost and want to be on the top step of the podium. That's it. What you may not realise is that cycling as a sport and as a pastime is one that is very important to Ineos as a culture. It's very important to the three owners of Ineos. They're all keen cyclists. They're very engaged in the sport. They're very engaged in what we do. I wouldn't say that any one of the three of them is more engaged than the others. I was with the owners last week, with Dave and Jean-Claude. Their ability to stay across all of the different sports teams and indeed all of their businesses is extraordinary. It's a privilege to have an audience with people like that who have such proven track records of performance across all walks of life, and we're very lucky to have them as owners. There is no question of Ineos's commitment to cycling. There is no time horizon put on that commitment. Ineos has a great track record of acquiring companies and sports teams and generating value and holding on to those companies and sports teams in the long term. That's it.
Well, chaps, going to have a couple of hot takes from you guys on Ineos, what they need to do, what they will do in a second. We heard from John Allott there. Scott Draw is the other kind of performance director who's come in there, who I think is going to be a key figure. But just listen to him yesterday, chaps. Didn't give too much away, John, but he talked there about Brailsford and Brailsford's role, the sort of spectre of Brailsford, how much it is going to loom over the team. I would put it to you that is pretty key going forward, because we all know that, for example, Rod Ellingworth resigned from the team a couple of months ago. I think if you were to wind the clock back a year ago and asked anyone at Ineos what Dave Brailsford's influence and role were going to be in 2023, they would have told you one thing, and what the reality was over the next few months was quite different. I think there were periods where they thought he was going to be more involved than he was, and then there was a moment at the Tour de France when he arrived at the Tour de France, visited the team and looked at what their transfer plans were, when he was a bit more involved than they maybe would have wanted and would have liked. And they can, as I said, they can have that idea for how things are going to work, but that needs to be the reality, I would suggest. Mitch, what do you think?
Just slightly away from that, but there's a massive loss of identity with that team. You know, for so long there, it was a team to follow. It was a team that had the goals, that had the dream, you know, to live that sort of British dream, to take the tour and, you know, everything else wrapped around with it, you know, with Cav there. And we all know the story. I don't need to repeat it, but a massive loss of identity the last few years, and that mass exodus of those, you know, key sort of British riders that came through the system, you know, Teo Gegenhardt. It was a bit of a surprise for me to see him step away, and just to see that change, you know, it made me understand that behind the covers, things weren't right there. And you've just exposed that clearly there. But an Aussie could be the fix. Oh, I won't doubt that. That's for sure. But that is something that needs to happen, not only for Ineos, but for, I think, for cycling. I don't want to sound like a romantic here, but they're great. You got to have them back where they were, back at the Grand Tours, sort of challenging things. There's been the last couple of years. We need that extra sort of push again from Ineos to push the two top at the moment, Jumbo and UAE.
They still got an impressive squad if you look at the who they got with Pidcock, Carlos Rodriguez, and a few others. But as Mitch said, the loss of identity is I think is a big blow. They started like with a commando spirit, like, we'll go for it in 5 years, we'll win the Tour de France. Nobody believed it. They did that. And then after a while, it's only logical that you have a kind of an anticlimax, a kind of a hangover. But there is one strange phenomenon that I can't really explain, but it's not only with cycling, but sports teams in general sometimes are embodied by someone. Like Quickstep is Patrick Lefebvre. We were discussing Total Energies, Jean-René Bernardeau, Groupama FDJ is Marc Madio. I mean, you always link, the Movistar is Eusebio Unsway, and then he took over from, but he was there from the start. When you lose, like, the father image that Braceford was, sometimes you have the impression the team loses itself. It doesn't know where it's going. The goals get far, less clear than they used to be. I think that's what's been happening with Ineos. We were mentioning the Tour Down Under, Stephen Williams, Oscar Onley. In these Team Sky days, these guys would have been with Team Sky. I mean, you were a British rider. There was no other choice, and there were no other options. And now it's great that, British cycling has new strengths and new young up-and-coming riders. But how come that these guys are not with Ineos? They would have been in the past. I think, there's a little bit of a lack of focus, a lack of identity, as you said, because managers and DSs have been coming and going. I don't exactly know what the solution is. You mentioned the new CEO. They've got a new guy as well. I don't know exactly what his role is, because, I mean, you've got all these names coming up, but you can't tell what they're doing. But Jean-Claude Blanc is up there somewhere in the hierarchy.
He's sort of on the Brailsford level. I think he'll be very involved with Manchester United, is the expectation, I think. A lot less involved with the cycling team. They have got this grand vision, and this goes back to when Jim Radcliffe took over the team. Ineos 2.0, if Team Sky 1.0 was about sort of marginal gains, which became this kind of catchphrase, which I think Brailsford regretted using, but the Ineos 2.0 or Team Sky 2.0 was going to be about this kind of cross-pollination of expertise in different sports. And you speak to people in the organization and they say that has been really successful. I mean, well, from their point of view, they found it really, really useful. The input from sailing, I think they had members of the Ineos coaching staff were in the dressing room for the All Blacks World Cup semi-final, and they've taken a lot from that. But they're a team that wants to win the Tour de France. And the issue is that they don't currently have anyone who looks as though they're going to be able to win the Tour de France soon. There was a lot of speculation about Remco Evenepoel in the winter. I've been told on good authority that they tried very hard to get Remco.
Especially with his low wages, as we learned from La Gazzetta.
They tried very hard and they reached a roadblock with that. Interestingly, they also tried to get Primoz Roglic. The conversations about Roglic and with a view to recruiting Roglic, they sort of stopped around about the time when I mentioned Brailsford coming to the Tour and the team pivoting on a few riders. We've talked about this in recent weeks. Carlos Verona is the name that, or is the case that most of the listeners will be familiar with. They decided they were going to sign him. Then they told him and his agent that they changed their mind. And this was the point at which the Roglic conversation sort of stopped as well. There was a lot of talk amongst sort of agents in that period that kind of Ineos and their plans, their vision, couldn't be trusted. There seemed to be this sort of indecision. Whether Roglic's agent decided, well, that was why it was a better idea to go to Bora Hansgrohe or not, But in terms of the timing, the sort of coincidence of the two things, they certainly matched up.
Yeah, I still think that when you need stability, even in a company, you know, like we talk about company culture, well, when you kind of lose Brailsford because he's everywhere but nowhere in the same time, you know, when you lose Rod Ellingworth, when you lose Shane Sutton for the reasons we know, when you lose Fran Miller, I mean, all those core people in Team Sky of the beginnings, what's left of the team culture and the team tradition? And I'm convinced it leaves the riders a little bit out of focus. It's the same with football. For reasons unknown to, how could I say, statistics or figures, teams with a history of winning a competition are better on the day than teams with the, you know, more money, more guys, but without the culture of the sport or the race. And Team Ineos, I'm sure would benefit from keeping a little bit of tradition going. Otherwise, they might lose themselves.
On the same note, what happens to a team a bit closer to me? What happens to a team like EF Education, you know, without Jonathan Vorders? You know, on a different sort of note, that team that's got to completely rely on sort of culture. And without Jonathan Vorders, I wonder what that team would really be. You know, say what you will about JV. You know, and personally, you know, there were up and down moments with him working with him, but he's created this unique culture there. Without him, where is that team? I don't know.
Yeah, there aren't too many examples I can think of, Mitch, where teams have successfully reinvented themselves or rediscovered another new emblematic figure and sort of changed the identity of their project. I mean, you know, you could talk about sort of Rabobank becoming Jumbo Visma, but I don't think any of us really think that is the same team.
No.
And that's really a good example. Both absolutely right on that. And the Vortis example is a good one, I would suggest. You know, Groupama without Madio. I know Yvonne Madio has retired this year, but Mark is still very much in situ. Well, Francois, it's about time. It's still breakfast time in Marseille, so you'll probably be wanting to go out and get yourself a world championship winning baguette.
I hate baguette. I've always hated baguette, so no way. No baguettes for me.
Baguettes generally are just the devil's bread, aren't they? Just rip the top off your mouth, and they're not really good on any particular score.
You know, they're good within the hour after they were baked. But if you buy them a couple of hours later or the next day, forget it. It's absolute crap.
They're good for sort of staving off intruders to your home. They're useful as weapons, but that's about it. It's bedtime as he rubs his eyes and looks as though he's had a hard week.
I've got to get some dinner. Yes, some very late dinner. But the tennis is on here, so it's Australian Open. So there'll be a game kicking off in a minute, and I'm going to go enjoy another cold beer, as you guys have seen, and some dinner. So, but great chatting with you guys.
No dry January for Mitch Docker. He's earned a beer. He's earned a beer after the week he's had. Chaps, it's been a delight as always. We'll be hearing from both of you in the coming weeks, I'm sure. Thank you very much.
The Cycling Podcast was created in 2013 by Richard Moore, Daniel Freed, and Lionel Burney.